Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University History Department titled Human Rights and Violent Internal Conflict. Our speaker is David Cingrinelli, professor of political science at Binghamton University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University professor of history, Simon Piaslin.
Professor Cingrinelli, some of you are familiar with his name and his work. He teaches political science at Binghamton University at SUNY. He has written widely on human rights, democracy, and governors. One of his articles he wrote with Tom Pasquarello was Human Rights Practices and Distribution of U.S. Foreign Aid to Latin American Countries, and also a book, Human Rights Theory and Measurement. And I mentioned those two specifically because when I was a graduate student in political science, it was really that article and that book that really inspired me to do my PhD dissertation on U.S. foreign aid and human rights practices by the recipient governments. So it's really a special privilege for me to have this opportunity to introduce the author of works that have actually inspired me to do research and writing in those areas. His 2000 book with Radwan Abuharb, Human Rights and Structural Adjustment, demonstrated the negative human rights impact of World Bank and IMF programs in developing countries. Professor Cingrinelli is a former president of the Human Rights Section of the American Political Science Association. Until 2012, Professor Cingrinelli served as the co-director of the Cingrinelli and Richards CIRI Human Rights Data Project, the largest and most widely used human rights data set in the world, covering 26 years, 15 separate human rights practices, and 195 countries. Professor Cingrinelli and his colleagues are working in collaboration with the United States Political Instability Task Force on a successor to the CIRI project, which will be called the Rights Data Project. And he was recently appointed to serve as the founding director of the Binghamton University Human Rights Institute. I have the pleasure to introduce you, Professor Cingrinelli.
Well, I want to begin by thanking Professor Piaslin, who I've known for more than 20 years and whom I very much like and respect. I've read his works on Armenia. I promised him I would devote part of this talk to human rights and violent internal conflict in the Caucasus, but I'm at a loss because he knows way more about it than I do, but at least it'll show you how the project I'm talking about applies to that region of the world. I appreciate all of you who came here today. I know that you had very busy days and other things that you could be doing. I want to talk to you today a little bit about the work I've been doing on human rights and this project on human rights and violent internal conflict, which I have been working on very recently. I mean, as background, I don't know how many of you actually work in the field of human rights, but I would be best known in that field as somebody who has tried to quantify the extent to which all countries of the world respect internationally recognized human rights. That's a big task. It's a controversial task. Some people think that there's something not quite right about attaching numbers to the human rights practices of governments. But I would argue that the first step to changing anything and to understanding why it changes and how much it is changing is to measure it. Otherwise, we can make statements about this respect for this right is improving, this one is getting worse, but what is our evidence other than our impression of things that we read, things that we see, and we don't know about most countries in the world. It's just impossible. I had thought, so in 1981, I began a project to measure the human rights practices of first Latin American countries. That's the project that Professor Payaslian talked about. And then in the mid-90s, we expanded that to include the whole world. And now we do have a very large data set, which we're trying to continue, in order to address questions of theoretical and practical interest. The one I'm talking to you about today is whether violations of human rights help explain the violence that we are seeing within societies around the world. So is some of that occurring because the governments themselves are violating at least some human rights of their citizens? So this project got started because in 2011, the World Bank published its annual Human Development Report, where it said that that violent conflict is the major obstacle to economic development. And if you were to look at that problem, that is where most violent battle deaths are occurring. Excuse me. It's happening in Africa and in the Middle East, and those are also the places where not much is happening by way of economic development. So the World Bank and the UNDP had decided that they really needed to have a project where they could understand the reasons for internal conflict in all countries, with particular interest in that region. And they approached me and some other human rights scholars to write a concept paper, they called it, on whether state treatment of its own populations could be one of the reasons. And the specific question was, could we identify the factors that lead to the onset of violent conflict, escalation, de-escalation in post-conflict situations? So that's what we addressed, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about that project today. Here's what we know. We know that human rights practices are correlated with various forms of political violence. So the kinds we look at in this paper are violent protest, terrorism, and civil war, both small-scale and large-scale civil war. If you were to look at do a statistical analysis, which we do, between the amount of violations of human rights that are occurring in societies and how much of those different types of conflicts are occurring, you would find that there is a positive relationship. More violations of human rights associated with more of each of those types of conflict. But the explanations vary quite a bit. So the explanation that I'm going to talk to you about today is that government violations of human rights create grievances which may result in violent acts against the state. So I'm treating human rights violations as the cause of conflict, but most of the field, most of the research on this correlation assumes the opposite. That is, that governments would like to respect human rights, but when their regimes are challenged by groups in society such that they fear that they may lose their power or ability to control society, that they reluctantly respond with things that we would call violations of human rights. So they engage in more brutality, which would get recorded as torture, or they in other ways, silence free speech, do all of those things that we would get recorded as violations of human rights. And I guess I should take a step back here. I can't assume everybody in the room studies human rights. So let me just say that in 1948, we got the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And some people have tried to come up with a list of all those rights that are in the Universal Declaration. And the list is somewhere around 40, somewhere between 43 and 50, depending on what you count and whether you have subdivisions. And the main categories are civil and political rights, which is what the UN and the World Bank asked us to focus on, and economic, social, and cultural rights, which they told us to not consider. But I want to, I'll talk to you a little bit about that in a moment. What we know, so I'm telling you that there's the main body of the literature says that the real reason for human rights violations is that regimes feel threatened by various groups within societies. They respond with violations of human rights in order to maintain their power. We're suggesting that the other might be possible as well, and we're not really sure. I can give you some examples of the ones that I think actually start with repression, just so that you get a sense for this. But we're just beginning with this research program that would try to demonstrate that human rights matter. So one of the reasons I'm doing this project, and one of the reasons I'm talking to you today, is I'd like to believe that that we would live in a more peaceful world if governments treated their citizens better, right? And I don't believe that governments are naturally inclined to respect the human rights of their citizens. Actually, I think it's very inconvenient for government officials to respect human rights. It's much easier to do what is expedient, to ignore the rule of law, and just get the bad guys whenever you see them. Right, so I think that it takes a lot of effort and a lot of societal monitoring to get a government to respect human rights. And I think there's this tendency for governments to eventually or often to resort to violations when it's unnecessary. What we do know, I talked about this with some students this afternoon, is that often we get into a vicious cycle, right? So there's internal violence and government repression. And they feed on one another. So I don't believe that once that vicious cycle begins, that is particularly meaningful to talk about what caused what. But at the beginning, I think we can see some cases where human rights violations led to violence. And I'll talk to you about two cases. I didn't pick them in any random way. I just wanted to illustrate to you that possibility. And as I see the research program that I'll be embarked on, involved in over the next few years with students and colleagues, it will be to figure out the kinds of research projects that will shed more light on this issue and help us better understand the circumstances under which reducing violations of human rights could help break the vicious cycle, right? That's the goal here. We've got all these places where both are happening at a very high level. It's very hard to get out of it. Professor Payazlian and I were talking about Azerbaijan and Armenia just recently, so I think it's going on right now in those countries, for those of you who've taken his courses and you're familiar with that conflict. So we'd like to figure out which is the cause, which is the effect, and under what circumstances, and what could be done once the cycle begins to turn that vicious cycle into a virtuous circle where respect for human rights promotes peace. And it continues. As Francis Fukuyama says, he talks about getting to Denmark. Denmark, he uses Denmark as an example of a country where things seem to be going pretty well. I would say on most human rights indicators, Denmark is among our top performer on all kinds of human rights. So how do you get from a very bad situation to a place like Denmark where there is respect for human rights, there is peace? And how do you get that to continue? I've got a chart later. I put Denmark on it just so that you can see that comparison in relation to the countries in the Caucasus and neighbors to the Caucasus. So this is what I'm going to be doing in the next half hour or so. I'm going to talk about a little bit about more about what previous quantitative scientific research has to say. Okay, so let me say a little bit about scientific. I use scientific really as a synonym for quantitative. So that's, for me, kind of redundant. It doesn't mean that qualitative research can't be scientific. It can be. But it often isn't. And, by looking at a single case and without making some arguments about generalizations from that case or a set of cases, we don't get to the point. So science, the purpose of science is to build theories about the way the world works and to test them and to refine them. So we're trying to build a theory of why violent internal conflict occurs. We're trying to see if human rights, practices of governments contribute to that. We know there's many other things that matter, right? The poverty of a country, whether it's ethnically homogenous or not, whether its neighbors are peaceful or not, its history of recent conflict, all these things matter. But do the human rights practices of governments have a separate, independent effect? And could we make a difference by changing those? And then I'm going to end this presentation. So I'll tell you what our research has to say. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about why measuring human rights is controversial, because it is. And whenever I give a talk on human rights measurement, I usually get a challenge. I'll tell you why those challenges come up. And it's not that they're illegitimate, but I told you why I think we need to do it. And I end with how can international actors, the World Bank and the United Nations Development Program ask that specific question. It's the weakest part of my presentation because, gosh, if I had the answer to that, that would be wonderful. I have some ideas, but there's a lot that we need to know still. So I want to say a little bit about previous human rights research. It focuses on politically motivated violence. In fact, the paper we did for the IMF and the World Bank focused on the things I told you about. Violent political protest, terrorism, and civil war. And the purpose of civil war is to actually take over the government, change the rules, and remove the people in power, insert new people, and change the rules by which the society is run. That would be, the most direct challenge, the most obvious kind of political violence that's taking place in the world. But one of the things that I've realized very recently is there's a lot of non-political, non-violent challenges to government authority that are happening around the world. And they also can lead to human rights violation. And I think in my future research, I'm going to pay more attention to that. And I use the example here of what's going on in the Philippines right now. I know I've met a lot of students who are interested in international affairs. If you're following international affairs, you've seen that the Philippines and Malaysia are in the news recently, along with the usual suspects, as places where pretty severe human rights violations are going on. In Malaysia, perhaps, what we'll look back on what's going on there as a genocide, certainly a mass atrocity and the number of people being killed and raped and mistreated. But in the case of the Philippines, I don't think it's political. I mean, it might be, but I think my reading of that situation is that there's organized crime. There's a drug trade going on in the Philippines. And President Duterte has decided that he would like to address that situation without paying too much attention to either international norms about how those accused of criminal behavior ought to be treated, or actually the laws of his own country. So I would say there are massive human rights violations happening in the Philippines, even though the violence that is occurring there is not to take over the government. It's to make money. I recently was in Mexico, where I would say the same thing is going on. There isn't much political challenge to the government of Mexico, but the drug cartels are engaged in a great deal of violent behavior in certain states of Mexico, and it has caused, or it has contributed to, major human rights violations, corruption of the police. You probably read about the story where the police allegedly killed a whole group of students for reasons I'm yet to understand. And so we ought to recognize that there's more than one kind of violence that matters here. And we shouldn't assume that the violence that is occurring was not had nothing to do with government behavior. Right? So we tend to blame the organized groups, but in some cases the organized groups are actually serving the interests of a local population and the government doesn't like it. I think I've talked about all that other stuff, so I'm going to just move on. So I want to talk about a couple of cases where I think I can make the case that the government started this. Right? If you take the case of Syria, and I actually don't know this case as well as my colleague Radwan Abuharb, who I've written with in the past. He talked about this case of Syria. It begins with peaceful demonstrations in southern Syria that demanded that the country democratize. So there was no violence in 2011 to begin with. And it was a protest against the right of people to participate in their government, which is an internationally recognized human right. But what happened is that the government responded to peaceful demonstrations with deadly force. We see this happen a lot. Something similar happened in Iran when there were demonstrations for pro-democracy demonstrations there. And those who demonstrated, many were thrown into prison, kept there for long periods of time, were beaten, were tortured. I think it's often the case that government repression is stimulated by peaceful protest rather than violent protest, political violence, that is, leading to government response. So you can read as well as I can, but those peaceful protests that spread, protester demanded that President Assad resign, and then eventually opposition supporters began to take up arms, first to defend themselves and later to expel Syrian security forces from their local areas. What happened after the violent peaceful protest led to violent protest. It led up to civil war. I mean, we kind of skipped the violent protest part in Syria. And then Syria descended into civil war. So I'm giving you that as a case where I think the government provoked, through its violations of human rights, provoked a violent response from the population. You don't have to accept that, but I think it's a reasonable case. And I'll give you one that you probably would think is less reasonable. That is, what we're witnessing in the United States today is in numerous cities, we see evidence of police killing mostly unarmed black men, right? And in each of the places where it's occurred, those are off the top of my head. There's many more cases than that. I think that it always began with a peaceful protest against what had happened. Sometimes they turned violent later, but I would say that the police killing is what begins this process. And it's an interesting question as to whether that police killing has actually increased, or is it simply becoming better known? I can't really answer that, but clearly the community that's affected feels like it's increased. And what's happened in all those cities is that there have been prosecutions, right? And for white people, that seemed like a fair thing. Right? There's a prosecution that's taking place. We're going to have a fair trial. We're going to determine whether the police did something wrong. In every case, the police have been acquitted. Every place we've had a trial. And I would submit to you that that's very predictable, right? You have a local prosecutor bringing charges against a local policeman, and that local prosecutor is dependent on the local police to build cases, right? To win cases in court, which is how prosecutors are evaluated. They cannot afford to alienate the police force. So I think there's a bias in that process in favor of the police and against those who have been hurt. And what I'm going to say to you, and I know I'm way out on a limb here, that we ought to consider the possibility that if the police in those cities respond with even more violence, and, you know, I don't want to get too far into that, but I think that's possible. You know, let's support the police, right or wrong. We have a law and order president. Instead of trying to promote some understanding and diffuse the situation, then I think that there will be more violence and maybe even terrorism possible, even in the United States. And it's awfully hard to make the case that it started with political violence against the government. But we'll come back to that later. I'll let you argue with me if you like. So we, in our research, we identified the relevant civil and political human rights. We ignore economic, social, and cultural rights. We try to predict the countries where violent conflict is likely to begin or to escalate in future years based on our human rights model. That is a model that incorporates human rights and other factors to see whether human rights matter at all, can be explained by other things. And we propose a new conflict prediction tool that would incorporate human rights. And then at the end, we were asked, like I said, to try to suggest policies that could be put in place if we thought human rights were important that would improve it. Again, weak part. We ignored these things. I think they could be really important, but we were instructed to ignore them. So we have parts of the world where unemployment is very high, so there is no right to work under favorable conditions. There, free trade unions are repressed in many parts of the world. In fact, in other research project, we demonstrate that respect for the right to organize and collectively bargain worldwide is declining. These are some of the other things that are guaranteed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I will just, as an aside, say that the notion that there's a human right to health care is an issue that hasn't even been decided in our own country, right? If you're following the debate on TV, we are seeing members of Congress say the right to health, there is no right to health care. It's not in our Constitution. It's not even something we should be doing. Because it requires just taking away from some Americans resources and giving it to others who don't have it. And that would be against what the United States stands for. So it's guaranteed as a human right that what it says in the relevant document is that government should do everything within their ability to promote these things. So there's an expectation in the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights that rich countries can do more than poor countries, but that every government should do what it can. And it is an internationally recognized human right to health care. But in this country, I didn't mean to bash on the United States, but in this country, there is no consensus on that. And you will hear over the next months, and if you've been paying attention over the last few, many people saying there is no right to health care. So here's our findings in a nutshell. The title of my recent book is that. We find that other things being equal, and I think these models that we've developed, these quantitative models, need refinement. So I'm not going to say too much that we've gotten all the answers here. But we find significant evidence that countries that don't torture, imprison for political reasons, kill without due process of law, or disappear individuals under their control will have more peace than countries that do, even when we take into account things like how rich they are and whether they're democratic or not, and so on. And this surprises me. We found out that countries that respect the rights of women to participate in the political system and the economic rights of women to participate in the economic system, that's also associated with more peace. I've got to think a little bit more about why that's true. We didn't just look at these rights. We looked at, I told you that there's something like 14 human rights we've measured. They were all in the model. The only ones that proved to be important are the ones that I've listed here. And some of you may have some ideas about why women's rights would be important. We have some speculation, but just trying to understand that. Here are things that I suspect, but we don't show. I think that the worst combination is to have high levels of violation in human rights with deep horizontal inequalities. Because I think that that's the kind of situation that would produce the strongest grievances against the government. Horizontal inequalities are political and economic inequalities along group lines. So in a society where you have a high level of, let's say, police brutality, and you have, at the same time, you have inequalities based on race, ethnicity, and religion, it's very likely that the disadvantaged group in those societies is disproportionately the target of those human rights violations, and that they will be the ones that will mobilize against the government. So the example of blacks in the United States, it's not everybody that's going to mobilize against the U.S. government, but it's very possible that that the black population will feel like they've been denied justice, and it might. And of course, there are other inequalities based on race in the United States, not just this treatment of them by the police. So that's the kind of a thing I want you to think about. And let me just say this: we advocate something called a negative residuals approach. If you take a regression model that would predict the level of various types of violence in society, you put all these independent variables, these causal factors in, and you predict the country's level of violence, and you find out that there's less violence there than you would have predicted. It means that the underlying factors suggest that there ought to be more violence, and you would predict that it will increase in the near term. So that's the kind of approach we're trying to develop, and it's I think the logic behind it makes sense. The countries that are right on the line, they have as much violence as you would expect given your model. Well, you don't expect it to change. The ones that have more than you would have expected, you expect that to decline. But those countries that are residuals, that is, they're below where you would have predicted, they're the ones that are in the greatest danger of escalation. I hope that made sense to you. So I'd love to talk more about this. I won't have a lot of time about it, but I will simply, I told you, I was going to say, measuring human rights is very controversial. A lot of people think it shouldn't be done. They definitely think I shouldn't be doing it. If anybody's going to do it, because who am I after all? And I never thought that at this point in my career I'd be still one of the very few. The other major project is the political terror scale. They do pretty much what we do. We think we're better. I won't tell you why. And this, I would tell you why during question and answer, because my colleagues who run that project aren't here. But in all fairness, I thought there'd be many more people trying different approaches to measuring human rights practices than we have. I think if we had that, we'd be able to say what the countries are that have good human rights and what are the ones that have poor human rights. One of the reasons that the United Nations doesn't do this is that they absolutely don't want us to know. They definitely don't want to give China or North Korea a score that looks awful. Right? Because what's the value in that? From their perspective, they don't see the value in that. On the other hand, if we don't know the countries that are doing well and poorly, we don't know where to apply pressure. We don't even know what it is they're doing well and what they're doing poorly. It's also culturally loaded, right? So if we point out the fact that women's rights are really poorly protected in certain countries, but those countries, for cultural reasons, think that that's just fine, then we have to have that kind of a fight, and that gets very messy. Right? I'm willing to have it, but they're not willing to have it at the UN. And, of course, my middle point there is that if the declining human rights practices provide scores for domestic challengers and international adversaries that countries don't want. So this is what I really enjoy talking about to my students, is that if you measure human rights, you have to say what full respect for that human right would require in a society. So, we'll just pick one. We could do this for a long time. I listed several at the end there. But I want to just pick freedom of religion. What does full respect for freedom of religion require? Think about the debates that are occurring in our own country right now about attacks on religion and the differences of opinion about what it would require. But the international standards, I think, require that everybody be able to choose to believe or not believe in God and some set of other things about God, and that they have the right to change their beliefs if they choose to do so. There's a lot of places in the world where changing one's religion is it's actually illegal, right? So those countries get poor scores. We think it requires that people be allowed to proselytize. That is, they be allowed to exercise free speech to convince us to change our beliefs. Right? That if you can't do that, then of what value is your belief really? But some people would say that the freedom to proselytize is really not necessary. So when we score countries, I've just begun to talk to you about freedom of religion, although I think I've given you the main criterion. We would give countries a lower score that didn't do those things, that discriminated against atheists, that discriminated against people who changed their religion, obviously discriminated against people who have a minority religion, and so on. And the forms of discrimination can be very subtle. They don't have to be outright violent persecution. It can be denying members in a certain group the right to own property, own buildings, that sort of thing. Or they can't build if they have a place of worship, it can't be made out of any permanent material. It just would. So when we get to reading these human rights reports, which I forgot to tell you, that's what we do. We read the reports produced by Amnesty International each year for every country in the world with a set of criteria. And then we read the reports of the U.S. Department of State, which is ever since the mid-1970s has been required to produce an annual report that talks about all these things. So if you're going to measure it, first you have to decide what you're going to include. And that's controversial as heck. And we get disagreements. Let me take a case where we have a current disagreement. Do international human rights require that governments not discriminate against people based on their sexual orientation? So the answer to that question is debatable. I think it does, because it prohibits discrimination based on a whole variety of other things, and then it has a catch-all phrase or other characteristics that they may have. And the principle here is that everybody is equal to equal dignity and respect before the law. But other people would say that since it's not mentioned specifically, enumerated in any human rights document, that it's not protected. Right? So we have to decide that or else we can't attach a score. And I would say this about the human rights, the list themselves, this list, the freedom of speech, the right not to be tortured, the right not to be politically imprisoned, that sort of thing. There's widespread agreement on that list, which breaks down as soon as you begin talking about what should we take into account when we decide whether that's true, whether it exists in any society. Does that make sense? That the, you know, nobody argues that there shouldn't be freedom of religion. But they argue about what it would mean. Does it require that people be allowed to change their religion? All right, so a little bit about human rights and violence in the Caucasus. And as I said, I'm going to defer to Professor Payaslian. For those of you who, like me, weren't sure what the Caucasus were, that's the Caucasus region. It's between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. And Turkey is not considered part of the Caucasus, right, Simon? No? And neither is Russia, but those other countries in there are. So on this table, across the top are various human rights, which you can't see now, but you will soon be able to see. And down the side, you see some countries. Russia and Turkey are there for comparison purposes. And the three countries from the Caucasus that I put up there are Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia. And I put Denmark up there just because it's one of those countries that people point to as, you know, really good country in terms of liberal democracy and human rights. And it, in this particular illustration, it works. The variables across the top are the ones we identified in our research as important. So this isn't a, all of the other factors that would come into play aren't on this table. So it's a very incomplete table. But red means it's not good. So in a square that's red, that means that there's no respect for that right. And you can see Russia comes out the worst in there. Russia doesn't have a heck of a lot of political violence, and it would be one of the countries our model would say is ripe for political conflict. More internal violence. So what is it? I mean, there are things about Russia. Turkey is experiencing internal violence, and we would say there's a high risk for it to continue. Those numbers at the end, for women's rights, there's two of them. There's political and economic, and instead of separating them out, I simply added them together. So that scale for women's rights goes from no respect to full respect. Full respect would be a society in which men and women are treated equally. Think about politics. In the United States, if you look at our political system, in most political systems now women can vote. But in the United States, a relatively small percentage of the legislature is female, high-level Supreme Court positions, cabinet positions, typically are dominated by men. So the United States would score as a 2 for women's political rights. Very few countries get a 3. That is, based on our criteria, women and men really have equal chances of achieving high political office and power. And economic rights is the same thing in the economic sphere. So the chances of women being hired for the highest level, highest status, highest paid positions, being treated with dignity and respect on the job, not having to undergo sexual harassment, for example, being paid the same amount as men for the same job. The United States, again, would be a 2. And you can see that on these two things, Georgia ends up with a 3 for political rights. I don't I didn't go back and read that that section of the State Department report which would discuss that, but no other caucus country gets a 3, but neither does the United States. But if you look at that, you know, it's ones and twos. So the only country in the Caucasus region, the highest level of respect for women's rights is Georgia. And at least based on their human rights performances, we would say that, you know, Georgia and Denmark are likely to remain peaceful. Those other countries have various levels of risk for increased internal violence. I'm a little reluctant to put too much faith in that table because I've left every other factor that's important out of it. But I think since it supports the case, and I promised Professor Payaslian and I would talk about the caucuses, I think it at least illustrates how that is. And you might have an objection about how we scored some of these countries, say, on the amount of killing going on in Armenia. So some killing means that the Amnesty International in that case, which does report on killing, says that there was more than zero killings in, this is not 2015, but fewer than 50. If it's more than 50, they would be in the worst category, which is where Russia and Turkey are, on killing, the only two countries that end up there. So, general policy implications. Specific policy implications. Here's where we would have liked to say more to the UN and the World Bank, but here's what we came up with. So one of the things that I think is an issue is that people don't really demand protection for human rights the way the UN thought that they would. They thought that through education, people would come to want their human rights and they would demand them from their governments. What we find, what I think is happening here is people want human rights for themselves. They don't really care so much about the human rights of people who are different from them. And so I think there ought to be more human rights education, especially about minority rights and the importance of maintaining respect for minority rights if you want a peaceful society, a peaceful, prosperous society. The UN has said that we ought to be training secondary teachers and administrators. I think that's a good idea because there's a lot you could talk about with human rights that isn't really covered. There's already some education of security forces, prison guards, police, soldiers, that ought to continue and escalate. This is this last one on this page to... I've done some research, as some of you know, on program lending by the International Monetary Fund. I think it's having negative effects on respect for human rights around the world. And we recommend that, just like the IMF requires an economic development impact statement for its work, for its lending, it should be asking also about what human rights were affected by the policies that were put in place to meet the loan conditions. There should be more national human rights institutions, especially in developing countries. We can talk about that if there's time. Truth and Reconciliation Commissions after severe mass atrocities, genocides, have been shown to make a difference in healing. Protect freedom of religion, because I think sectarian violence is a major cause of conflict around the world. And a research project that I'm interested in is to see whether these national efforts to promote human rights education actually have good consequences or any consequences. And I will stop right there. Thank you for being so patient. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the United States. You seem to lay some blame at the doorstep of the local justice system in the numerous acquittals and apparently what seem to be going against the evidence. So you're suggesting a reform or jurisdiction change for crimes of that nature? And you mentioned, of course, the educational system, which would be long-term. But do you think the primary concerns we have, what's going on in the country now, obviously based on our racial system, is the main culprit here?
Well, so I'm not a lawyer. Let me admit that. I'm just, I think, an informed citizen about this, and I'm happy to hear the argument against it. But it seems to me that we've seen several situations where it seemed obvious that the police overstepped, used excessive force. I don't think anybody actually disagrees with that, but the judges and juries have said, well, their fears were justified and therefore we're not going to punish them. I think that's, you know, we have to be more willing to reprimand police. I'm not saying throw them in jail for the rest of their lives, but at least to say, you know, what you did was wrong. You shouldn't be a policeman. You shouldn't be on the streets if you're going to panic in situations like that. And I think until that starts to happen, there's going to be more violent protests, and it could escalate from there. So I thought somebody would challenge me on that. I put it in there to be provocative, to be honest with you, because I think it fits the argument.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. Appreciate it.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by David Cingrinelli, professor of political science at Binghamton University. Professor Cingrinelli's lecture was titled Human Rights and Violent Internal Conflict. It was presented by the Boston University History Department. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Professor of History Simon Piaslin. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Ian McCarr. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Leidotes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.